Called in a Council of the Prophets, The Mission of Hugh Nibley by Thomas Hugh Nibley. I will start with an explanation of how I came to believe the things I will talk about below. I was only a child when Mom happened to mention that some years before I was born, Dad had surgery that went badly and he died. Then he came back to life and was available to become my father. Now, just how cool is that? Believe me, I was stoked. And Dad's stock went way up in my estimation. Over time, it came out that Mom had had a similar experience during a difficult pregnancy. I couldn't believe my luck. As far as I knew, mine was the only family that could claim such experiences, and we had two to go on. I don't know why, but I don't recall ever talking about these things with my siblings, or for that matter, with my parents. Maybe we did discuss them, and I simply don't remember. But for me, it was enough to know. I never doubted that life continued after death. After all, isn't that what the whole church, religion, creation, life, death, sacrifice, atonement, Jesus Christ, resurrection, etc., is all about? I mean, what's the point of having life at all if it just ends someday? That would be stupid. So I always believed. But to have someone go through the veil and come back, that still struck me as unique and very cool. So I was always interested in stories about transvellular tripping, which could be found in scriptures and church history, but were otherwise hard to find. Then in 1975, Dr. Raymond Moody published Life After Life, and the floodgates opened. Moody coined the term near-death experience, NDE, for what he described, and so they have been known ever since. Dad read the book and followed, by my recollection, with two family home evenings devoted to examining and explaining what this sort of thing was about and telling us about his own experience. Dad said that he hadn't seen anyone, but had discovered that it is possible in the environment in which he found himself to learn incredible amounts of knowledge at unbelievable speed. He liked that. In Moody's book, people met friends and family members who had preceded them and had wide varieties of experience. The hereafter seemed to be bigger than we were accustomed to thinking of it, and why not? The visible universe also seems to be a pretty big place. As time went on, more books came forth and I tried to get all that I could find. Then came the internet, and now it is possible to dive into an ocean of NDE stories. I have now read thousands of them. They can be sorted according to their importance, and this is why I am digressing into a broader realm of discussion that may seem to have little to do with the life and work of Hugh Nibley. Most NDEs are on a level of vacation trips or previews of things to come. These can be very gratifying to those who have them, imparting the knowledge of continuing life that comforts both those who experience and those they can tell about the experience when they return to mortality. They tell a simple fact of existence and may be equated with a trip to the grocery store. Some people, because they deal with life after life in the spirit world, put such experiences in the realm of religion and say they should be dealt with by religionists and theologians. But in reality, it is a simple fact of existence, which needs no more ecclesiastical validation than any learning we may pick up as we live our lives. It does inform the experiencer that something is there, but it has nothing to do with the keys and ordinances that lead to eternal life. Those require councils. In this world, it is possible for any citizen of a free country to visit any other free country just to visit. I went. It was pretty. There was a tower. Loved the place. There were rocks, lots of rocks, and mountains. Uncle Charlie was there. He says hello. We had a reunion. There was cake, and so forth. This is the spirit world. It is actually a part of and continuation of this world. Nothing is required to enter it but shucking off our mortal husks. There are others, however, that go into spiritual realms as something more than ordinary citizens. They can be compared to government officials of earthly nations. These are they who go on special assignments, ambassadors, emissaries, diplomats. These require documents and powers to be given that empower them to negotiate, make treaties and commercial agreements, etc. Those powers come from the governments involved and are only given to those who have been selected and approved for the tasks. There are likewise ambassadors who are called and assigned to serve between heaven and earth. They are prophets, apostles, angels, and ministering spirits. These receive callings which are officially extended in councils. The Book of Mormon does us the great good favor of showing us how this is done in its first chapter. Lehi was carried away in a vision, even that he saw the heavens open, and he thought he saw God sitting upon his throne, surrounded with numberless concourses of angels, in the attitude of singing and praising their God. Lehi is given a document, a book which he reads and approves, then accepts a commission to prophesy, testify, and manifest plainly the coming of a Messiah. This council reminds us of the great council which took place before the foundation of the world, as we read in Abraham 3, 22 and 23. Now the Lord had shown unto me, Abraham, the intelligences that were organized before the world was, and among all these there were many of the noble and great ones. And God saw these souls that they were good. And he stood in the midst of them, and he said, These I will make my rulers. For he stood among those that were spirits, and he saw that they were good. And he said unto me, Abraham, thou art one of them. Thou wast chosen before thou wast born. It is reasonable to me to believe that Lehi also was chosen before he was born, and was then given mortal commission to renew the previous commission and validate it in the mortal world, a new and everlasting covenant and commission. To receive that commission, Lehi has now fulfilled the condition of having stood in the council of God, which Jeremiah alludes to when speaking of the qualifications of a true prophet. For who hath stood in the counsel of the Lord, and hath perceived and heard his word? Who hath marked his word and heard it? Jeremiah 23:18. And I might add, who is ready to serve God in power and authority? That such counsels are an ongoing concern, vital and dynamic, is shown by the experience of Heber J. Grant. I seem to see, and I seem to hear what to me is one of the most real things in all my life. I seem to hear the words that were spoken. I listened to the discussion with a great deal of interest. In this council, the Savior was present. My father was there, and the prophet Joseph Smith was there. They discussed as to whom they wanted to occupy two empty positions in the Quorum of the Twelve, and decided that the way to remedy the mistake that had been made in not filling these vacancies was to send a revelation. It was given to me that the prophet Joseph Smith and my father mentioned me and requested that I be called to that position. I sat there and wept for joy. Which brings me to Hugh W. Nibley. Dad spent the last 2 years of his life in a hospital bed in the front room of our old house, with the main burden of care falling on Mom. I was there to assist. He was deeply concerned with finishing his last book, One Eternal Round, and would send me to libraries and bookstores looking for research material, mostly on sacred geometry. Physically, not much was accomplished, but I would sense from time to time that there was work that transcended the veil. I believe that when I cross over, I will be able to look back to that time and see that Abraham, Enoch, Joseph, and others made visits. There came the time when Dad moved on, and the family was called upon to say a few words about him. I was impressed that I should express my feelings on the nature of his calling and commission. What came to my mind was that there had been a specific council of prophets that convened to analyze the possibilities and situations that would arise throughout the earth's existence from the time the prophets spoke and down through the ages into our days. Knowing the teachings and ideologies that would be coming from all angles and shades of the spectrum, it was determined that there would need to be many preachers, prophets, and ministers sent to counter what would be coming from the adversary and his forces. It was apparent that secular attacks would be a major source of trouble. Philosophies of men that deny the power and even existence of the spirit, relying on the physical senses and the evidences derived from them, historical as well as scientific, can, in the hands of pens and voices of skilled scholars and rhetoricians, seem eminently logical and obscure the truths of spiritual realities so completely that those realities appear to be either ridiculous or actually non-existent. And so, I believe, it was determined in this council that Hugh Nibley would be given gifts and powers of scholarship that would match or exceed those of the secular scholars he would encounter. He would not be a prophet or an apostle. They are the appointed officials whose authority allows them to administer the ordinances and proclaim the laws that are necessary for moving on from the mortal and spiritual worlds through judgment and the resurrection into the kingdoms of glory that can only be reached through obedience to the laws and ordinances that apply, as we learn in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 88, verses 36 through 39. All kingdoms have a law given, and there are many kingdoms, for there is no space in which there is no kingdom, and there is no kingdom in which there is no space, either a greater or a lesser kingdom. And unto every kingdom is given a law, and unto every law there are certain bounds and also conditions. All beings who abide not in those conditions are not justified. The laws are established, sent forth, and administered by God and his chosen prophets, apostles, and priesthood ministers. Hugh Nibley was not chosen to be one of them. No. His assignment was more that of an expert witness or advocate for the defense. In order to carry out that assignment, he was gifted with talents of research and scholarship that were prodigious. With him standing as guardian, secular scholarship could never claim victory because they simply could not overcome his brilliance, no matter how hard they tried. Of course, they tried. And they would claim eminence on the grounds that Hugh seemed to actually believe all sorts of stuff about revelation, connections with God and heaven, life after death, and eternal verities. So he must be some kind of nutcase. The secularists took comfort in that image of him, while believers rejoiced that a man with such worldly skills really and truly believed and bore testimony to the truths of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In order to carry out his mission, one other gift was indispensable: humility. The recognition and sure knowledge that without the assistance of the Spirit, he was nothing and could do nothing. Since it was imperative that he interact with the world of secular scholars, he was constantly aware of his relationship with them, and they often flattered and cajoled him. At the same time, there were some within the church who disparaged his work and urged him to take a stance that would be more in keeping with the world's current stock of wisdom. I believe it was his continued connection with the council that kept him from succumbing to their enticements. When asked how he was able to accomplish the prodigious work he did, his answer was often a single word: prayer. And then on rare occasions, I also heard him mention that he had a private arrangement with the other side, which he thoroughly enjoyed. He was and is a unique man with a unique calling. It is gratifying to see that there are now many excellent scholars in the church who are following the paths he mapped out. They are doing good and important work, and it is the work that Hugh Nibley performed that opened the way.